Welcome to the N1 podcast, where you'll get an inside look at stories from the Clemson MBA team,
as well as entrepreneurs and innovators from Greenville, South Carolina, and beyond.
Brought to you by the Pfeiffer Innovation Hub at the Clemson University MBA program.
Welcome to N1. This is Jamie Patterson coming to you from the Pfeiffer Innovation Hub in Greenville One. Welcome to our show today. I am so excited for all of you listeners out there as we've had so many different guests over the year, whether they were students or employers. But today we have one of our new professors. So Travis Box is with me today. He is an assistant professor of finance at Clemson. He just started with us in the fall semester. So Travis, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We're so excited. And you know, funny for me, because we'll get into this, but finance was not always the easiest of classes for me. So I'm actually excited to talk to you more about your background and kind of why finance. So let's get started. Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, in terms of my background, I think that I came to finance late. As an undergrad, I was an economics and math major. And then it was one of those things where felt like I'd worked pretty hard, but not exactly clear what I wanted to do after I completed my degree. So I did what a lot of people do and went back and tried to get another degree. And so this time it was another economics degree, a master's studies this time. And still had not really found my interest in finance yet, but I was in a first semester statistics course. And the professor of that class was married to a portfolio manager, and they were looking for somebody to help with their numbers. Mm-hmm. So it was like a junior quantitative analyst position. I must have been doing pretty well in the class because she asked if I would be interested in applying for the job, and so I ended up taking that position. And having never had a finance class in my life, I think I'd maybe taken one semester of accounting, just showed up just to do numbers. I realized pretty quickly that I liked it. So I started at that point taking MBA finance classes through the master's program, and ended up liking it so much that turned into a full-time job. And then eventually decided to go back and get a PhD in finance a couple of years later. So kind of by accident.
So you got bit by the bug by accident.
Got bit by the bug.
But always numbers based. It sounds like everything that you've done has really been on the quantitative side.
That's absolutely true. That's my background. I hope that's not necessarily the direction that I have been moving in the last couple of years. Early on, they always tell you, whether it be looking out for how much emphasis we put on STEM education,
yes,
of various kinds, this is always emphasized as incredibly important because I think numbers are hard for some people. Well,
I just raised my hand. Yes, me.
But the truth is it's it's only part of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And more and more, as I get, I don't know if to say as I get older or hopefully a little wiser, I see how valuable softer skills are. And if you kind of think about the most successful people that you know, I would argue that most of the time they're not successful because they're really good at math. It's probably some other reason. So those last couple of years, I've tried to try to get out of the numbers a little bit, or at least expand my horizons to other skill sets.
I love that. I think that's such a great combination because it is. I've seen it myself going through my own MBA program, and I see it through some of our students that finance is a really tough thing to grasp if it's not something that you're doing all the time, or if it's not really the path that you're looking to pursue. So how do you connect with those students? Is it through talking more about soft skills and how to be successful that way? Or how would you connect with a student like me who's just not a finance person?
Well, what is so exciting about the new position from here in the MBA program is when I was a PhD student at Arizona, I worked with masters of finance students. So all numbers. When I was a professor at Ole Miss, I was teaching finance majors exclusively. And now I am interacting with people who I'm only a very small part, or what we're doing in my class is probably only a small part of what they're trying to do. And so that gives me an opportunity to learn from them. Yeah. And I'm really excited about that. And I think that that's just the discussions that we had in the fall semester in the class. It was really a neat opportunity to hear people explain to me why they're here and mm-hmm. what they want to do with these skills and how finance can fit into that. And it's probably not said enough how much professors enjoy the opportunity to learn from their students as well.
Oh, absolutely. And how lucky are we that we get to work with this population of MBA students?
Absolutely.
And I always say that. I don't know that there's another population because everybody comes with different backgrounds, mm-hmm. different experiences, and kind of have different goals. Mm-hmm. And it's so much fun to watch them grow and turn into whatever that is. So absolutely. I love watching it and being a part of it. So I love to hear that you do too. So tell me about the class that you're teaching this semester.
This semester, we're going to try a new class on investment banking, and it's called Investment Banking Strategy. Investment Banking Valuation Strategies. And hopefully, we're going to try to figure out a little bit about the institutional detail in the industry, what investment banks do, a little bit about their history, major business areas, and then we're going to also do some of those numbers, mm-hmm. Look at specifically how to value maybe an acquisition target or an IPO, leveraged buyout, look at how capital would be raised if necessary in all of those situations, and hopefully spend a lot of time looking at current or near current events in the actual deals that are going on right now in the market.
Very interesting. So a lot of real time.
Oh, absolutely. The students are expected to each week work in pairs and describe, to tell us something, tell the rest of the class, make a presentation about a deal that's currently ongoing.
Very
or,
nice.
Or recently completed.
Very nice. So you spend time in the classroom, but also on the research side. So tell us a little bit about your current research.
So in this paper, we're looking at competition between ETF providers. And when we say competition, we're actually talking about the fees that they charge for those ETFs. So each year, however much you have invested in one of these funds, the investment management company will take a small percentage of that and keep it as their own revenue, okay? These funds are put together. They hold portfolios of other securities. And this has been, over the last two decades, ETFs have been one of the fastest growing investment products in the market. Mm-hmm. Just this last year, we've probably exceeded $4 trillion in assets. And that's, you know, you go back to considering that the first ETF didn't even exist until 1992, that's a tremendous growth. I think in 2004 we had about 150 ETFs. This year we have over 2,000. So, lots and lots of new funds coming online. Lots and lots of growth in this area, and there's been a lot of commentary in the financial press about how all this competition, all these new funds coming in, has really lowered fees for investors. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of our motivation. We wanted to say, well, if you pick up a copy of the Wall Street Journal in the last couple of years, you know, every couple of weeks they'd be running a story about how much money investors are saving because of these drastically falling ETF prices. We were a little bit skeptical of those claims just because of some of the other research that we had done. We had looked at how new ETFs had affected transaction cost and market quality before. So we kind of already had a sense of what this type of competition might be doing to fees. And what you would start to notice if you looked at some of these articles is some of the companies that were, some of the investment management companies that were being mentioned as big fee cutters typically don't offer ETFs that are really all that cheap. Mm-hmm. So it might be kind of like if you go to Walmart on a like 4th of July weekend, they might be selling Coca-Cola at the front of the store at a really, you know, really low price in the hopes that you pick up a disposable cooler and three bags of ice, right? Maybe that these, cheap ETFs were just kind of loss leaders, in a way. And so we started to look at it from that perspective, and generally that's kind of what we found, that while it's absolutely true that in for certain types of funds, there are just tremendous deals available to investors, like deals that normal people today can buy a total stock market index ETF. So that would be an ETF that basically holds every single stock in the U.S. stock market. You can get that ETF for about 4 basis points. When I was in portfolio management 15 years ago, institutional investors were paying, 10 basis points for that same portfolio. So retail investors today have access to better deals than institutional investors did, 10, 15 years ago. However, that's not true for just every single type of ETF that you pick up. As a category, people associate this investment product with low fees, but some of them are really low. Some of them maybe aren't so low. And that's kind of where our motivation for this paper came in.
Okay, wonderful. And so this was just published in the Financial Analyst Journal. And it's really funny because I was meeting with a student earlier today, and he kind of let me in on that this was the whole reason that he came back to school, was based on a lot of the stuff that you've researched is really what he's interested in. So I thought it would be fun if he joined us today and maybe asked you one or two questions about your research and about this paper in particular, and kind of get this conversation going a little bit more on the side of ETFs and what we can expect in the future. So so Jesse, would you like to introduce yourself to everybody, and then please go ahead with your questions for Dr. Box.
Yep. Current and former student of mine.
Jesse Keitel. Just finished my first semester as a full-time MBA student. Had Dr. Box last semester, his first semester here, and next semester for investment banking. So can you explain the difference between low and high fee ETFs, and why is there that difference in cost to the investor?
For the most part, the fee that the investment management company charges, historically, this is supposed to describe how much they're actually paying to manage the fund. And so if you, just as an extreme example, if you would think about a commodities ETF, they would have to hold a bunch of futures contracts that would need to be rolled over every 6 months. And so in an ETF like that, the entire portfolio would have to be bought and sold, every couple of months. That's obviously going to be very expensive to manage. That doesn't mean it's too expensive. That just means for that strategy, it's going to be expensive. If you wanted to look at an ETF that maybe just holds the members of the S&P 500, well, as long as the members of the S&P 500 don't change very much, and they don't from year to year, you might have the same stocks in those portfolios for decades. And so there you're going to have very low expense ratios. And in general, if you're talking about a 5 basis point fund or a 40 basis point fund, that's going to be that should be the biggest difference in their prices.
So most of it would boil down to the level of activity and management.
That's what it's supposed to. That's really what it should be. And they're still going. That's where the if you're going to say why does this fund have high fees and why does this fund have low fees, that's almost certainly going to be the reason. What we've seen lately, though, especially in the last year, between 2017 and 2018. We suddenly saw, after years and years and years of aggregate fee declines across the ETF industry. So each year, the average percentage of fees that we all paid for these portfolios was falling in every year since the financial crisis. And then all of a sudden, they stopped falling. this was particularly concerning for us because we kind of wondered why. And when we got to looking at it, it really wasn't because investors were shifting money into these types of strategies, maybe like a commodity fund, that should be more expensive. There weren't really any meaningful changes along those lines. What we found was that it was because investors were shifting money into ETFs, into passively managed ETFs, into simple, maybe benchmark to an equity index ETFs that were just charging more than funds had in the past. And a lot of this phenomenon has had to do with a sudden investor interest in into various types of risk minimization. So for instance, certain funds might choose their holdings by calculating the volatility of all stocks in the market last year and then sorting that list and picking just the stocks that have the lowest volatility. Okay. In the grand scheme of things, there's nothing about that portfolio that really should be any more expensive to own and hold than, you know, any other passively managed index. But it seems like more and more investors, it seems like investment management companies are charging a lot more for those types of strategies. So if you wanted to have a portfolio that didn't have a lot of risk, for instance, for 20 years, you've been able to buy an ETF that maybe holds the utility sector or something like that. And you can get a portfolio like that for 8 or 9 basis points. Suddenly, though, when we call this now a low volatility strategy, investment management companies are charging 40, 45 basis points. And we're not really sure. There's no operational argument for why that portfolio should be more expensive when all they're doing is, you know, sorting volatility in an Excel spreadsheet.
So pretty much investors are paying a premium to have lower volatility.
They're paying a premium for stocks that had lower volatility last year. And that's the rub, because next year Apple's going to come out with a new cell phone, and in that phone there's going to be a better processor than our phones have in them right now, right? And when we say better processor, that's a better processor because we can actually give this new processor a series of calculations to do and demonstrate that, yes, it does have better performance than your old processor did, right? It is faster at performing these calculations. Simply saying that, well, here's a list of stocks that had lower volatility last year and charging you 5 times as much money for it, there's no guarantees whatsoever that low volatility is going to continue into the next year. It could be low volatility simply by accident. And oftentimes, especially a good example, categories that you think of like a category like tech, for most of the years following the financial crisis, technology companies experienced pretty much one directional returns, right? Most of these companies did very well. There wouldn't have been much day-to-day volatility in their prices. And certainly companies like that would have shown up in these low volatility portfolios. Then suddenly 2018, 2019, that sector has, well, volatility has returned to that sector in a major way. So historical volatility, not necessarily a guarantee that you're going to experience low volatility in the future.
Fair enough. What are your biggest regulatory concerns for ETFs?
Well, so there's a common perception, I think, in the media and probably even academic finance, that the fact that so much of our stock market is held by passively managed funds, that maybe this has some potential problems. And And so the problems that would be commonly cited here are, well, if everybody is holding a passive portfolio, the kind that typically makes up an ETF holding, who's doing the fundamental analysis? Who's making sure that the stock price is right if everybody's just buying the index? And so there's a lot of concern stemming from, well, should we be worried that we're basically putting so much of our wealth on autopilot? I'm not sure that I can think of a particular policy response if such a concern would be warranted, but I think that is an anxiety that's widely shared by a lot of people. The other issues that's specific to ETFs is that now we've got this passively managed security that owns entire chunks of the market at one point in time that in the old days, if you wanted to make a bet on an entire industry, you might have to buy, you know, 20 or 30 different stocks. Now you can make one targeted investment in an ETF and potentially move the entire market at one time. And so does this cause problems if people in episodes where maybe people are a little more hysterical than usual? And that's another concern that people have raised over the years. But in general, I don't think that there's actually been much evidence that either major concern related to the ETF market has a lot of empirical support. In both cases, it doesn't really seem like in some related research that we're doing, we haven't found direct evidence that investors' sentiment moving in and out of the ETF market is leading to price disruptions in their underlying securities or regular stocks and bonds.
Have you seen it at least creating noise in the market and potentially giving new opportunities to traders who can take advantage of, I guess, mispriced securities?
So with regards to the noise, with regards to the opportunities, what we've seen in the last couple of years is a fragmentation of markets along a lot of dimensions. In the old days, if you wanted to trade General Motors, somebody would have to physically go to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange to do that. Today, you can trade General Motors on 18 different physical and electronic trading platforms. You can also trade General Motors by buying probably 700 different ETFs, right? Where General Motors might be a small piece of their holdings. This fragmentation, I think in a lot of people's minds, there might be a potential for fragility. You know, as we get more broken up, you know, maybe the system becomes less stable. But I'm not sure that that's been realized, at least in any way that we can measure empirically. With regards to the opportunities that are being created across markets, you know, now you certainly have traders, and when I say traders, what I really mean is computers, that are set up to constantly monitor the price of General Motors in all of the equity exchanges, physical and electronic, and also the prices of all of these ETFs that hold General Motors in their portfolios. And so anytime we see a deviation there between maybe where General Motors is trading at in Chicago and New York, or maybe the value of an ETF that holds it, anytime that you see a deviation there, there's the opportunity for that deviation to be corrected through trading. All right. So that certainly opened up a slew of new trading opportunities. But in the process, it's now given people who want to provide liquidity to the market, maybe somebody who's willing to sell General Motors, right? Or maybe even if you wanted to show up to an exchange and sell your shares of General Motors, a little bit of cushion, knowing that they can either take these shares off your hands or sell you these shares, and that nothing that they do is going to impact the price all that much, right? And so that you've got this sort of anything that they're naturally doing in the liquidity provision process is sort of naturally being hedged by all of these other equity exchanges and these basket securities ETFs as well at the same time. And there's a good chance that these secondary channels might be dampening volatility, not and noise, as you say, not contributing to it.
So with the liquidity of ETFs and how quickly they can be traded, what are the effects on taxes and all that comes with that and the turnover of these securities and products?
Yeah. So the nice thing about ETFs is, especially relative to the, you know, well, if you're kind of new to investing, like ETFs are commonly viewed as an innovation relative to maybe like mutual funds, right? And in a mutual fund, you can trade them once a day. You could buy it at 9:30 in the morning, but you weren't actually going to get it until 4 in the afternoon. So they traded it only one time a day. And it was considered what they called a pass-through security. So anything that your mutual fund manager did during the year, like they bought a company and then sold it a month later for a profit, well, that's a short-term capital gain at that point, then taxable as such. And suddenly, you are now responsible for that short-term capital gain because all of the profits and tax obligations of that security are passed through directly to you. So ETFs are something of an innovation there because we don't necessarily experience taxes in exactly the same way. They're not going to have capital gains distributions and quite like the mutual funds did. So in the grand scheme of things, one of the other benefits of an ETF besides being able to trade it throughout the day is this essentially like they're a little more tax advantageous, especially for somebody who wants to hold it long term. As long as you buy your ETF and hold it for a year, you only realize long-term capital gains obligations as a result of doing that.
The Clemson University MBA program is home to full and part-time corporate and entrepreneurship degree programs, a part-time business analytics program, and the new online MBA. Learn more at www.clemson.edu/MBA.
So I'll end with just by asking where you stand on passive versus actively managed funds. And I guess for an individual investor or a family versus an institution.
Well, we quote John Bogle in the paper, and I'm going to mess this up, but you're basically saying we all underperform on average by the amount of fees that we pay the investment industry every year. And there is absolute truth to that. We can't all win, right? And for every winner, like in on average, right, there somebody else was going to be under by exactly the same amount. So, but when you take a passive approach, you're essentially saying whatever the market's going to give us, that's what we'll take, and we'll try to spend as little money as possible to get that. When I'm teaching introductory investments, usually the first thing that I will tell students is, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in the market tomorrow, and you don't know what's going to happen in the market tomorrow, and nobody else does either. And if they tell you that they do, they're lying, right? Whatever happens tomorrow is completely unknown to all of us, but I know exactly how much money my investment manager is going to take from me, and I know exactly how much money the government's going to take from me. And those are the two most important things to minimize first. Everything else is maybe, maybe not, but I can minimize taxes and I can minimize investment fees, and that will lead, that will have a measurable positive impact over the long term. Now, as I said before, when we talk about these societal concerns about, you know, are we spending too much? Are we all investing too much passively? Are there not enough of us doing the proper fundamental analysis on our stock market or bond market? Well, in the grand scheme of things, there should be some sort of equilibrium here, right? If it was ever the case that too many of us have gone passive, right? And that now there's nobody's actually paying attention to, should company A's price be higher than company B, right? And we need to really look closely at company A and company B and figure this out. If there aren't enough people participating in that process, then suddenly there's now an opportunity for profit for an active manager, right? Somebody can come in and say, hey, I'm just going to pay attention now. And as it turns out, company A is underpriced relative to company B. I'm going to go out, I'm going to buy company A, I'm going to short company B, and now I'm going to make a profit. That equilibrium should be there. So if there are too many of us in investing passively, then that's only going to make the world better for people who believe strongly in an active management framework. Unfortunately, for the last 20 years, just look at average hedge fund returns, right? They've been terrible, and not just bad, but really bad. It's almost impossible for an active manager to beat the market 3 years in a row. Like statistically, you just don't see it. It almost never happens. And what's crazy is that even if they were blindly picking investments, not even trying, they should be able to beat the market half the time, right? Half of us are going to be above the market and half of us are going to be below the market each year. So if you flip a quarter three times, I mean, it's not impossible for you to come up with heads three times in a row. And the fact that you just almost never see that says something about the actual either abilities or opportunities for active managers. Apparently, the evidence seems in my mind pretty conclusive that their fees are probably unjustified, at least at this point. But with the equilibrium thing, that maybe that won't always be true.
I'll sneak in one personal question since you brought up John Bogle.
Okay.
Warren Buffett had Benjamin Graham to look up to. You mentioned John Bogle, who founded Vanguard, if I'm correct. Is there anyone else that you've looked up to?
I would have to say in this particular context that I look up to all of those people, and I quote all of them frequently. But especially in that list of names, I think that we all owe a lot to John Bogle. Then him being the founder of Vanguard. We don't say it in our paper. We were very careful about not trying to give away too much information about the names of the investment management companies that we were studying. But I don't think it would surprise anyone to learn that if you're an investor in a Vanguard ETF, you probably are in the lowest price ETF in your category. They have about 90 ETFs, and they're pretty much all the cheapest ETFs in their category. So they have operated by that philosophy for a long time, and I think provided the amount of money that they have saved their investors through decades in the mutual fund industry, now in the ETF industry, has gone a long way to make people's lives better. If you avoid paying, if you can pay 10 basis points on average across your entire portfolio versus, 100 basis points on average across your entire portfolio over your investing life, you will retire with tens of thousands of dollars more when it's all said and done. So there are meaningful benefits to their philosophy, and Jack Bogle's largely responsible for that.
So we're back, and Jesse, does Jesse not always ask the best questions? I watch him in all of our employer spotlights, and he does. He always has the best questions. So I love that, and I think this is such a testament to N1, as that's what we're called here, that our students have the ability to be able to have these conversations with our faculty members about what they're passionate about. So I think that was really great. We might have to do that more often where we bring in a student. Although, Jesse, you set the bar really, really high. That was amazing. So just circling back before we wrap up, I would love to know throughout your career so far, what are you most proud of? I stumped you. See, Jesse, my questions are good too.
Yeah, so
I'm just kidding.
Can Jesse ask me another question instead?
I know, right? Now we're getting back to the soft stuff.
In terms of my career, well, I think at the very beginning of our conversation today, I talked a lot about how there was no doubt that when I was a freshly minted PhD and I was first completely cut loose on my own with students, that my quantitative tendencies were driving my view of students' abilities and talent and potential.
Yeah.
And even in the investment space, your ability to do math could be useful. It could also be completely worthless. It could also, I mean, I'm not going to say hurt you, but over-reliance on it is very dangerous. And so I think that I would say that it's something that I am proud of, as I hope that over the years I've broadened my perspective a little bit in that regard. And I hope that that's helped me in the classroom and probably my research as well, sort of to understand the different types of skill sets people can bring.
That's amazing. So what best advice do you have for young professionals? You work with young professionals on a daily basis.
Well, for the most part, I think people need to, for the last couple of years, I've done a lot of work with students on interview prep. And
yes.
So I suppose that this is relative. When I say advice for young professionals, I don't know, people are always, I feel like I'm supposed to say something like, you know, find something you love and you don't ever work. Like, I think I love investments, but I still think I work. Sometimes it's still work.
So no, interview prep. I want to hear about this interview prep. That's very important.
But on interview prep, like over and over and over again, you know, we can spend a lot of time chumming up with really detailed questions for you. Like, you know, we could ask Jesse to explain the steps of a leveraged buyout right now and grade him on his ability to get down to the nuance of all those things. But at the end of the day, like, you can pretty much cut a interview cohort on very simple questions, stuff that is completely non-technical. And it's amazing to me over and over again that people would come into an investment interview and not have, I could say something, and again, in our context, that should be simple.
Sure.
Tell me about the PE ratio. And it just completely whiff.
Absolutely.
In full disclosure, I have whiffed on exactly that question in an interview. I think it was 2009, maybe. I was interviewing at a mutual fund in St. Louis, and so it would have been an equity analyst, like intern position at the time. And that is exactly what they asked me, and I completely whiffed on it. And I know for sure that my response to this question is what ended up costing me that an opportunity But that I've replicated, asked students similar questions year after year. You know, what happens to bond prices when interest rates fall? And people that have been in, that are trying to get a job in investments and they'll struggle with those basic questions. So I think that speaks to is maybe people should try to maintain a big picture view of what they're looking at, because I think rarely is an organization going to ask you detailed questions about what they do.
Yeah.
Right. Most of the time, I think business professionals are trying to communicate with you in whatever amounts to a universal language.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And for us, that may be balance sheets, which is scary because I never had much accounting training, much formal accounting training, but anybody that's been through the MBA program should be able to talk about, at least at some level, be able to explain the balance sheet impact of buying a new piece of equipment, right? It's not fun. Or I'm sorry for the if for two accountants for saying this, but it's not really a fun thing to talk about, but it is our common language, right? And we should all be able to speak it.
No, absolutely. And I think that that's a wonderful thing to be able to really coach our students on what to expect in those types of interviews. And I think from previous failures, like you're never going to forget that question.
Nope, not at all.
You can say it in your sleep. And I think that that's where the beauty of you kind of mentoring and helping these students go through these interviews is just so wonderful. So I appreciate that from our end too. And I just want to congratulate you for being published in the journal and for all the great research that you've done, because again, there's so much interest in this topic and it's going to be really exciting to see where it goes from here. So I love that you're on the forefront of all of this and that our students are able to consume this knowledge as it's happening in real time, which is really interesting. So before we wrap up, we got some fun questions to ask you.
Okay.
But just first, off the top of my head, I really want to know, you're new-ish to Greenville. Mm-hmm. So how's that been? How do you like Greenville?
So to be completely honest, I didn't know anything about Greenville or South Carolina.
Yeah, so you moved. Tell everybody where you moved from.
So we were living in Oxford, Mississippi, because I was on the faculty at Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. My wife was from St. Louis. I grew up in Southeast Texas. Peachy's from Arizona. So we had been like, this is now our fourth time zone. So we'd kind of explored the whole western side.
Welcome to the east side.
Yep. But just as soon as I was here, first of all, Greenville One is a phenomenal facility, and it's where it's sitting is even better, right? We have windows. I can see mountains from every direction. Beautiful tree-lined streets downtown. There's a waterfall. I think I had honestly seen one real waterfall my entire life before coming to mm-hmm. South Carolina. And now there's one right up the street from my office. So everybody in my family is very happy to be here.
Good. It is pretty magical to have that waterfall in the middle of downtown. That's something that never gets old.
Yeah. So. Yeah, no, and when we first, my wife and I came out here for a housing trip in the spring, and we took a trip to, we were like, well, hey, there's waterfalls here. What if we went and looked at one? And so we ended up going up north of Clemson to Issaquena Falls.
Yeah.
And they have a tunnel there, right? And we thought, well, that would be a nice twofer. And I guess the waterfall itself had kind of like a romantic backstory. So that was all very nice. But where you park, you're right by the tunnel. And so we pulled up and we got out and we started looking at this tunnel. And then we're like, right to the left of the entrance, there's this like waterfall. And we're like, that is awesome. How cool is that waterfall? And then we went and did the tunnel. And then we were going back to the car and we realized the actual waterfall was about 100 yards away, and we had been taking our picture in front of what was basically a ditch running off the side of a hill. And because from our perspective, that was a really, really pretty waterfall. And then we saw
the waterfall. Oh my gosh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, and so perspective on waterfalls has been completely updated since.
I love that. So you're from Texas, so who's your team? Are you a Texans fan?
Both Carson and Jesse know this. We have three children. The most recent was born in, he's about 16 months old now. And we call him our World Series baby.
Oh.
So we're diehard Houston Astros fans, being from Southeast Texas. And Springer, which is his name, he's named after George Springer, the MVP of that World Series. Springer was born 9 months after the Astros won the World Series.
All right.
So that's the source. That's where he came from, and that's where his name came from. So
I love that.
We follow football like,
yeah.
But I think now, I think obviously our football team is the Clemson Tigers.
Absolutely. Go
because
Tigers.
Since I accepted the job, they have not lost.
Okay. So you're good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Mm-hmm. And another good thing about college football is that while I was on the faculty at Ole Miss, we beat Alabama twice.
Okay.
And so then since I accepted here, Clemson has beaten Alabama. So I think I'm 3-3 against Alabama during that time period, which is probably as good a record as you will hear from any faculty member.
I like our odds. You're a good luck charm.
Unfortunately, we're not going to get to face them again this year, but
we'll see. Are you a dog or a cat person?
So
these questions are really stumping you.
I'm definitely a dog person. I'm definitely a dog person. I have a today is the 11th birthday of my Chihuahua Rita.
Oh my gosh, happy birthday, Rita.
So she's probably my best friend. And we bought her, we got her when we moved out to Tucson, Arizona, and we were very excited about the Latin culture. We have this, like, we bought this old adobe house and a lot of Mexican pottery and decorations, and then we got this Chihuahua. So we were very excited until we found out that she was actually born in Missouri. So we had been speaking Spanish to her for the last for like 6 or 7 weeks, and then her papers came in and we found out that she was born in she was actually from the Midwest. Had no idea what we were saying, but she's 11 years old today, and I hope that she has 11 more years.
Aw, that's
but
sweet.
But I have a cat. I have a cat.
But you love Rita more. I completely get it. I do not have a cat, but I could understand if I did, I would love my dog more.
Yeah.
So what? Who's your favorite band, or what is the best concert you've ever been to? You can pick either one.
Okay, so
this is where we get to know you really well.
Yeah, I don't know. So I've been a member of the Pearl Jam fan club since the 90s. So every time they come around, I like to see them. So there's that. I really like, obviously, I think just, given my age, which you can probably now infer, I'm a huge Radiohead fan. But lately, I don't know. We'll just leave it at that. We listen to a lot of music. So music is probably like a big hobby of mine. Like I would say, outside of maybe finance, maybe.
Finance and 90s grunge.
Well, I hope that it's a little bit broader than that now. Since we've got these fancy music subscriptions where you don't really have to.
Right.
There's no financial consequences from listening to literally. Yeah.
You don't have to go buy. You don't have to wait in line to buy the album.
No, don't have to do that. You don't even have to ever say a word. You don't even have to like say words like album anymore. No, they're just songs that just never stop. And so that's nice for us.
Have you seen Pearl Jam in concert?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. A couple of times. Hopefully though. We're going to be doing that again pretty soon. I think the tour is coming up. And hopefully maybe I actually get to take my son this time.
Oh, how fun.
So that's,
that is special.
Now we're at the age where we're all bringing children to concerts. So
I love
it. He did get to see Radiohead in utero at one point.
Okay.
But
so
he doesn't
there.
Remember that.
Yeah. I love it. Best place you've ever traveled.
That's a tough one. And this could be like, this is probably not a popular opinion, but I really don't like to travel. I like being at home with my stuff. And so, my stuff, I mean family. and my TV and stuff. But We have to, I mean, you end up traveling quite a bit because of to attend finance conferences or go present papers at other schools. And so I feel like I rack up plenty of hotel nights in a given year. And, you know, I'm always the type where I'll try to book the flight to where if I'm presenting that afternoon, I leave that morning and then I like, you know, go out for dinner and then fly back the next day. So that's kind of, now that said, we have a conference coming up in April, and for the first time in a long time, I actually made the decision to, well, I'm going to stay a one day longer because I've never been to Fenway Park. So I was going to the conferences in Boston, and hopefully I think I present on Friday, and then their second home game of the season is on Saturday. And
oh,
so,
nice.
I figure if it's just me by myself, like yeah. I might be able to maybe actually afford a ticket to like maybe sit in the Green Monster or something. We'll see.
Yeah, that's definitely a bucket list, especially as a baseball fan, I'm sure. So,
but that's, I don't know, that's like pretty rare. I will say the last time I was in Boston, I had the best sandwich I've ever eaten in my life, which was basically they took an entire lobster.
Yeah.
And just laid it on a piece of bread. And that was, as it turned out, pretty much all you need.
Yeah, I think the last time I was in Boston, I had the best cannoli I've ever had.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's magical.
Well, we should figure out which restaurants those two are at and switch.
We will swap ideas for sure. So I know you're new to Greenville, but what has been your favorite coffee joint so far? Because we have so many right around here, right around Greenville 1. So what's been your favorite spot so far?
everything, I don't know, I feel like,
you're going to be like, I don't drink coffee, Jamie.
No, I do. I love coffee. I basically make a pot in the morning and then I just drink the whole thing. And so rarely does it come up that I drink coffee in the afternoon. That said, where we're building our house out in Powdersville, they have a Coyote Coffee out there. And we've, like, the kids absolutely love that place. So I've probably been there 5 or 6 times. For somebody who says they never go get coffee, it's nice. I've enjoyed that
You're
place.
You're a regular there.
I've enjoyed that place very much.
Best pizza in Greenville.
Okay, so this one's, I honestly think that they haven't been open very long, but we had it maybe once or twice, and then we just kept going back and back and back. So I think we've been to I may say it's wrong, Todaro's Pizza.
You're saying it right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess they're actually from Clemson.
Yes.
But the location here in Greenville is, the kids love it.
It's fun.
We love it. They got a nice little fun place for the kids to play outside in the front. So we've had a lot of fun there.
Good. That is a fun spot. What about Best Brewery? There's a lot of fun breweries for the kids to run around too.
Yes. That's a huge favorite of ours. Yeah, and I've actually seen colleagues there. So I think it seems to be a widely shared activity here in Greenville. But when we first got here, we spent a lot of time at Birds Fly South, and I think the Hampton Station area is really cool, and they've got the big play area. But I do not want to offend anybody, but I just don't think that the beer was quite there.
Okay. The tacos were, though.
The tacos. So you are absolutely right about the tacos.
Good. Tacos
are great. So then for the second leg, we were staying in a house just north of the office here, and we started going to Liability Brewing a lot. And I think consistently they've had the best beer.
So do you
also have really good barbecue next door to them as well?
Do you know that somebody that works at Clemson and Career Services, her and her husband own Liability, Kathy Horner?
I did not know that, and so they're.
So I can't wait to tell her that it's your favorite.
So no, I would say they. I'm almost going to say easily. I think that they have the best beer in town. They also seem to be huge Star Wars fans.
Yes,
which I think. We discussed the scheduling for this particular interview. It had to be scheduled around the premiere of the movie.
Absolutely.
Tomorrow.
Always.
So it's always a big hit with my kids to go in and see all the Star Wars memorabilia. And my wife loves their, I'm going to mess it up. It's It's a beer that has the word gnome in it.
Okay.
But I can't remember exactly what it is.
Well, I love that there's the Clemson connection there too. They're everywhere. But yeah, that's amazing. So speaking of Clemson, orange or purple?
There aren't many other schools with purple. Unfortunately, the only other one I can think of is LSU. I don't know if their purple kind of makes our purple look bad by association, but I'm probably still going to say purple.
Nice. Yeah. What is your favorite show to binge watch? Not that you have time between having small children and working.
We were huge. I don't know. The show that we just finished watching recently that we really enjoyed was The OA, which has been now canceled by Netflix, but that show like probably didn't make any sense at all, but it was a lot of fun. And then lately, we've been watching Servant, the new Apple Plus, and then of course we were huge fans of Game of Thrones and many of the other big ones. But I would say those are probably in terms of like maybe shows that aren't super popular. Those are.
Yeah.
Shows that we really liked a lot.
And with movies, is it safe to say Star Wars is up there?
Absolutely. I think that I used to be a respectable consumer of, I'm going to use the word, film. It was something that, like, I think we really liked to watch movies a lot. And then I had kids and I don't do that anymore. Shows are great because you can watch an hour worth of television before you go to bed at night. I'd never have, if it's not a movie that my children can watch, I pretty much never have time for, there's just no way to fit that into my schedule. So I take what I can get. And lately it's the fact that there is so much Star Wars content mm-hmm. is really nice. I think when my son was about 4 years old, if you've ever heard of the series The Clone Wars?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. So my son was about 4 years old. He's seven now. Like one of the first things that we ever did together was we just watched. It took like 2 years, but like just watched every episode of The Clone Wars. There's something like seven seasons or something.
Oh my gosh.
But that was the first thing that we really like did together.
Yeah.
And that's ever since then, we've just been now we're fully in. So we dress up to go to the premieres and
I love it. I love it. That's amazing. Well, I really appreciate you spending your time with us today and sharing all of your research with us and having a great conversation with Jesse about that. And we just love having you on board here and love having you a part of the Clemson family. So we wish you continued success and we'll have to do a follow-up and kind of continue the conversation as kind of your research grows and see what's next.
I would love that.
So wonderful. Well, have a great day, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by the Clemson University MBA program and sponsored by the Pfeiffer Innovation Hub.
Thanks for listening to the Clemson MBA in One podcast. Hear more stories at www.clemson.edu/MBA/podcast.